Congratulations, everyone. We've survived Christmas, more or less. I certainly know that compared to how I would usually feel having a traditional Christmas, that I'm feeling much better at this point in the day than I would usually be. So that's good. So today was a little bit of a busy day, wasn't it, yeah, for a retreat. So it was a bit of a shame, but it's all good that there's so many activities happening, but still. So at this point we've been practicing together for some time. We've all had the chance to sit. We've all had the chance to experience something. We've all had the chance to feel something. And we've all had that awareness of what it's been like to just sit still and allow experience to unfold. Allow things to just happen. And so this is very much what meditation is about. The ability to just watch. So just see what's happening. To not get involved. To not get caught up in things. And normally we get so identified with our thoughts. We believe our thoughts so strongly. When we have feelings or emotions, they're so important. They're so overwhelming. When we sit meditation on retreat, we just stay still while all of these things happen. Whatever thoughts happen, they just happen. They come and they go. Whatever feelings happen, they just come and they go. And things which in that moment seem to be so important, they just pass by. A few minutes later, we've completely forgotten them. Ah, that's impermanence. That's suffering. That's not self. That's all of those teachings from the Buddha, which we've heard so many times. And now we're watching them. We're watching them unfold before our very eyes. So for this evening's Dhamma talk, I want to expand a little bit on the Metta meditation and teach you some more of the method. Why do I want to teach you the method? I want to teach you the method because I'm very compassionate. And I want to give you something to do that will distract you from your meditation. I want to give you something that will take your mind off your meditation. That's what we call a meditation method. Meditation method is something that you do to stop yourself interfering while meditation happens. That's a somewhat unconventional definition of a meditation method. What I mean by that is, your mind knows already Your mind, the nature of the mind is to know. Whatever we're doing, wherever we are, whatever circumstances we're in, our mind is always knowing. We can't stop it from knowing. Meditation, of course, is just the training to help our mind to know better. But how do we teach our mind to do what it's already doing? This is why teaching meditation is such a puzzling thing, such a paradoxical thing. I'll give you a simile, a little parable that I thought of one time. It's like there's a man who's walking along a path through the jungle, and he comes across another man. And the second man is standing in a pool of water, splashing around in the pool of water, jumping from one place to another, putting his hands on the water and like pushing downwards on the water, leaping all over the pool and creating a big mess everywhere. And the second man comes along the path, he says, "What on earth are you doing? Why are you jumping around in the pond? Why are you pushing the water?" And the second man says, "Well, I'm trying to make the water clear." He says, "Sorry?" He says, "I'm trying to, the water's muddy, and so I'm pushing the mud down to the bottom of the water. And so by pushing the mud down to the bottom of the pond, I can make the water nice and clean." And so the man who was walking along the path says, "Ah, I see." He says, "You know, I have a better method that can help you to push the mud down to the bottom of the pond." He says, "Really? Because I've been doing this for a long time already and it doesn't seem to be getting any cleaner." He says, "Yes, I've got something that can help you." He says, "Right, what do we do?" He says, "Well, first of all, we need these ingredients. We need some wood. We need some grass. We need some a kettle. And we need some cups." He says, "Really, what do we need those things for?" He says, "Don't ask me, just get them." So he goes off and gets those things. They get the wood, they make a seat beside the pond. And they get the grass, and they use the grass to make a roof for the pond. They get the kettle, they boil some water, and they get the cups, and they make a cup of tea. And then they sit on the seat, in the shade underneath the grass, and they watch the pond, and the water in the pond has got clean all by itself. And while they were busy on the shore, making their little nice little seat to watch the pond got clean all by themselves." So that's what I mean when I say that a meditation method is something which is there to take your mind off the meditation. Meditation method is there to distract you and to stop you from interfering, because your mind will become pure all by itself. You just have to stop interfering. It's the nature of the mind to become pure when the conditions are there. As long as we stop jumping around, messing things up, it'll be okay. The mind will be okay. So you have to have a sense of trust. Trust that it will work out. I don't know if you've ever had an experience like that in meditation, but that's certainly how it feels to me when I'm meditating. You know, I feel like when I'm meditating, I kind of sit there and I try to do my meditation method. And I sort of meditate. My mind's thinking about this and that, and you get distracted by this and that, and this happens and that happens, and then all of a sudden, you reach a point and you sort of realize, oh, hang on, somehow my mind became peaceful. And I didn't even notice. Sort of in the corner of my eye, you realize, oh, your mind sort of became peaceful all by itself. And, well, I guess somehow it maybe had something to do with the meditation I was doing, but really it just seems to have got peaceful. So it's important, I think, to look at things in this way. Look at the mind as something whose nature is to become peaceful, whose nature is to become clear, whose nature is to be aware. Because so often when we're on retreat and when I hear people talking about their meditation, people talk about the struggles that they have. I keep thinking about this and that. I keep falling asleep. I keep having problems with anger and so on and so forth. And we focus on all of these things that are happening. And very rarely is there anybody who says, I was aware of the thinking. I was aware of the sleepiness. I was aware of the restlessness. I was aware. I was aware. I was aware. Because all of these things happen in awareness. All of these things happen in the mind which is knowing. And if you don't know, if you're not aware, then you will not be aware of thoughts, of emotions, of restlessness, of sleepiness, of all of these hindrances and all of these things that we get so worried about, so concerned with on the retreat. So remember, all of these things are secondary. They're actually not that important. Thoughts come and go, feelings come and go, memories come and go, emotions come and go. Don't worry about those things. Let them come and go. They're like the clouds passing in the sky. They're like the waves coming in on the ocean. Don't worry about them. You worry about awareness. What do you know? And when you start paying attention to awareness, we realize that we are aware all the time. And that is the essence of a meditation. Now, you come to the metta. Okay, so your distractions. I'm going to give you some more distractions to keep yourself occupied with tomorrow. All right, and so I'll give you some a little bit more of the metta meditation. So I just want to give it out a little bit at a time to give you a chance to practice with it. To recap on where we were yesterday, we started with doing mindful awareness. Just aware of whatever's happening, not judging, not favoring and opposing, just letting it pass, letting it be. And then we started developing metta for oneself. May I be happy, may I be happy. And I emphasized on paying attention to the quality of the words that we're using, and the quality of the words, may I be happy. That care and attention bringing to the words. Using those words to remind yourself of the wish that we have for our own true happiness. And again, remember that this is a matter of, intuition or trust. It's not a matter of working out what happiness is. Okay, that's a different thing. But it's a matter of a very fundamental, perhaps the fundamental wish that hides in the heart of every sentient being, the wish to be happy. If we can feel, then we feel pleasure and pain, and we want to feel pleasure. We want to be happy. So everyone has this very, very basic wish to be happy. So we remind ourselves of that wish. And then the magical part of metta meditation, the part which isn't necessarily rational or not necessarily expected, and that is that if you have that wish, and if you keep that and sustain that wish, and if it's pure and genuine and real, somehow that happiness appears. Somehow just having that wish for happiness And then the happiness is there. How does that happen? I don't know. I just do the meditation. It works. It appears. Yeah? And so we have that happiness. And then I emphasized to hold the happiness, keeping it in the mind, keeping it safe, nurturing it. And remembering this is what makes the difference between the metta of loving kindness in meditation and the metta of ordinary life, and that is that metta in meditation is something we have a degree of control over. We can evoke it when we wish, and we can keep it and sustain it for as long as we like. Eventually, when we train the mind. Okay, so this is about as far as we took the meditation yesterday. So what I want to do today is talk about how we can develop it further. So when the feeling of metta is there, one of the very important aspects of Ajahn Mahachachai's method was that the feeling of metta is something which should always be very embodied. It's something which you experience in your body. It's not something which is kind of floating around in the clouds. And I think this is something which is not always understood very clearly when people are practicing metta. We say the words, you know, ahaṃ sukhi to homi and so on, and we have this kind of general intention, but there's not a real focus on what the actual feeling is. And this is where Ajahn Chachai's teachings I found to be very useful. So we emphasize to bring the feeling inside your body. So you actually feel the metta, like it's like a tactile sensation inside your body. And when the feeling which you experience originally, normally you'll feel it to start with in one particular part of the body. And yesterday when I was talking, I said to focus on the heart. And of course that's often where people will feel it. But it doesn't have to be there. Actually, it can be anywhere. It doesn't really matter. As long as it's somewhere inside the body. So wherever it appears, just focus on it in that place. Keep the mind on it. Hold it. When the feeling is reasonably stable and reasonably you feel confident about it, then just gently move your mind around, sweeping the mind through the different parts of the body. When you sweep your mind through the different parts of the body, you take the feeling of metta through the different parts of the body. Yeah? Little bit by little bit by little bit. Until you can feel it everywhere in your body. Now, sometimes, and this is one of the questions which came up in some of the interviews, sometimes you have parts of your body which maybe resist the feeling of metta. So maybe there's some feeling of tension in part of the body, or maybe there's a pain or something like that. So if that's the case, then just sort of ignore that bit for now. Work your way around that bit. Don't, if you try focus too much on trying to bring metta to that part which is painful, then you can risk sort of losing the strength of the metta in the first place. What you'll usually find is that if you move the metta to all of the parts in the body which is easy to spread metta to, and then you just bring awareness back from all those different parts to a single whole body awareness. So you have an image in your mind of your whole body sitting saturated with loving kindness. Usually when that happens, you'll find that that actually will encompass and include even those painful or difficult bits which were resisting the metta earlier. Usually you'll find that's the case. So this is our goal. And so Ajahn Mahachachai really emphasizes this very strongly. He says that to help this, if you're finding it difficult to get the feeling of metta grounded inside your body, then what you can do before you start doing the metta is do a visualization of your skeleton. And so again, this is your skeleton your skeleton as it appears inside your body, not somebody else's skeleton out there, but this one, this skeleton, and you go through each bone in your skeleton until you can visualize in your mind each skeleton, each bone in the skeleton clearly. And he said, when he was explaining it, he said, Tang Ru Tang Hen, which means both knowing and seeing that part. Okay, so you, each bone, you can, you both see it in your mind's eye, and you also feel where it is in the body. And you can actually feel where all your bones are if you pay close attention. You feel that sense of hardness inside your flesh. And so you very patiently go each of the bones until you can both see it and know it. Yeah. And have a picture of an internal image of your own skeleton. And then you spread loving kindness to the whole skeleton. Okay, so I don't usually do that when I'm doing the guided meditation, because it takes a little bit long to do the visualize all the different bones in the skeleton. So, but it is a good practice to do, and it is very useful. So if you want to get that feeling of metta even more grounded, then that's one way that you can help. Okay, so when you have that feeling of metta through your body, and it's settled, and it's even, and it's steady, and it's strong, and it stays there for, oh, let's say 20 or 30 minutes, something like that, then that's what we say is the completion of the first stage of metta meditation. Okay, so that's loving kindness for yourself. The feeling of metta at that point is what we call the metta nimitta, or the preliminary nimitta. The Pali word is the uggaha nimitta. Okay, so in, you're probably familiar in breath meditation, the nimitta of breath meditation is usually a light. Yeah, that's the most common way that the nimitta appears in breath meditation. And when, what, when we say that we use the word nimitta, the Pali word nimitta, the word nimitta very simply means sign. And what is it a sign of? It's simply a sign of the mind becoming purified. That's all. So the nimitta is just a, like a message or a sign which your mind shows itself when it's becoming purified. It's the way the mind appears to itself as it's becoming purified. Okay, so in breath meditation that tends to happen in the form of a light. In metta meditation, it tends to happen as the feeling of metta. And so when that, there comes a time when you're doing the meditation, when that feeling, it becomes almost like it's locked into place. It becomes solid. There's a centeredness to it. Yeah. And it's that solid, centered, grounded feeling of metta that we call the metta nimitta, at least the preliminary nimitta. The fully developed nimitta happens later, and I'll talk more about that tomorrow evening. So in the first stage of metta, when we're developing metta for oneself, we try to develop at least a metta to that stage. And then we're ready to go on to do metta for a loved person. Okay? Now, when we're doing metta for a loved person, we need to bear a few things in mind. First thing is metta for a loved, the loved person should be somebody who we have a very simple and uncomplicated love for. Remember when I was talking about earlier how metta is a very childish kind of emotion, yeah? And so when we want to develop metta, we don't want to bring up all of the complicated and mixed feelings that we have most of the time when we have kind of close, mature relationships with people, yeah? We just want to have simple, childlike, pure love. So it's best to choose somebody who maybe not the person who's closest to you, but maybe somebody like a niece or nephew, perhaps a teacher, a good friend, perhaps grandparents, something like that. Somebody who you can have a simple, uncomplicated love for. Not somebody who you have a love-hate relationship for, not somebody who you feel a sexual attraction towards. Someone who you feel a very simple, childlike love for. And the other piece of advice that we usually say in metta meditation is don't do metta for anybody who's dead. Because you never know if they're going to come and visit you, if they like the metta so much. And that could upset the meditation. I think that's one problem. But the other problem is also a similar problem, that if you do metta for somebody who's dead, who's passed away, then also you can have grief coming up. Yeah. So again, that can disturb the meditation. Please be clear about what I'm saying here. I'm not saying don't develop metta for these people. I'm saying don't choose this person as your loved person when you're doing the formal meditation sittings. Okay? If you just want to spread metta to different beings and include all the people in your family or people passed away, that's fine. That's what we should be doing. Yeah? But I'm talking specifically and solely about the person that we select for that main person to develop metta for in the meditation. Okay? Now, because in the meditation, it's a very specialized development. It's very sensitive. So we have to be much more careful about how we go about it than we are normally. Yeah? So this is why we take all these precautions. You should choose only one person to develop metta for in one loved person in each sitting. Okay, you can choose different people in different sittings if you like. That's not a problem, but only one person per sitting, and you should choose them before you start the meditation. Okay, so you don't sort of get to that stage and then say, "Oh, my meditation's well. Why don't I go to the second person? Okay, who's the loved person? I love Fred. No, well, actually, I don't love Fred all that much. How about Frank? No, there was that time the other day." And yeah, so make sure you choose the person beforehand, right? And then you can go on to develop that. Now, usually doing metta for a loved person is not too difficult. In fact, as we mentioned yesterday, a lot of people find metta for a loved person easier than doing metta for oneself. Yeah. So if that's the case, then if you like, you can start out by developing metta for a loved one, and then when that feels full and complete, then you can go to developing metta for yourself. Okay, so you can reverse the order of that those first two stages if that suits you. The same principles apply when you're developing metta for the loved person. Develop it in exactly the same way until it's just as full and clear and steady and stable through the whole body. Yeah? Yeah? And then do metta for oneself. When that feeling is really developed and is really full, then the nimitta, the feeling of metta, will be the same whether it's for oneself or for a loved person. And then when we go on, we develop metta for the neutral person and the disliked person, again, it will be the same for those stages. Ultimately, this is what we're aiming for. We're aiming to have the metta the same in all of these different stages. And that's why we develop it in this way. We're developing it in this way precisely so that we can overcome these emotional differences that we have between oneself and others, between people that we love and people we don't care about, and so on. And so we want to develop the metta until all those kinds of distinctions fall away. So little bit by little bit by little bit, we're going to get there. Okay? That's the aim. Now, one of the things that was mentioned yesterday was about what to do when the feeling of metta doesn't happen. What do you do when it's just boring? May I be happy? May I be happy? Yeah, whatever. May I be happy? Yeah. Okay. First thing, and just to repeat what I said yesterday, is don't be in too much of a rush to do anything. Okay? It's normal that, especially when we're first developing it, it's normal that sometimes the feeling will come easily and other times it won't. Actually, when you develop the meditation more and you become more skilled at it, you'll become used to recognizing. When we first sit down, we do the period of mindful awareness, you'll learn to recognize how is your mind, how is your emotion, how is your mood at that time, and whether that's going to be a good time to go on to doing metta or not. Yeah? And you recognize, oh, now is a good time, and if I do metta, you know, my mind will respond to that well. Another time you might think, well, actually at the moment, you know, because of such and such a reason, it's not going to really work to do metta now, so I'll try some other meditation. Yeah? So this is gradually we'll learn these skills. These are the skills that only come through experience. For now, while we're just learning, you just experiment. You give it a go and try, see how it works. So, I want you to be patient and just give the basic method a good shot first before trying anything else to get the feeling going. Okay, just be patient, just allow the feeling to come. But if you are getting a bit frustrated and you do think maybe you'd like to try to get the feeling happening, then there are a number of different tricks that you can use to help that. One of them we mentioned already was to, instead of starting with doing metta for yourself, to start with doing metta for a loved person. Okay, so that can sometimes help. Another thing that can help sometimes is using memories. And again, we talked a bit about this, I think, last night. So you can use some kind of memory of an experience when you felt loved, or an experience where you, a memory of a time when you saw an expression of metta, yeah, something that you remember. One thing about these memories is it doesn't have to be a memory that's particularly profound. Okay? It can be something that's very simple. And remember, always with this meditation, it's the simplicity and the purity of it which is the key. So when I think of that, if I try to think of what's a time when I saw an expression of metta that was very pure, one of the memories that I have was of a time when I was staying in Bodhinyana Monastery. And at that time in the monastery, there was, next to the monastery, they had sheep paddocks. And so from time to time, some of the sheep or the lambs would get lost. And this one time, some of the laymen staying in the monastery had found this little baby lamb, which had got lost come through the wire somehow and got lost in the monastery, and they found it. And of course this lamb was very kind of distressed and quite maybe injured or something, I'm not sure. And they put it in a little box, wrapped it up in some blankets, and they brought it up to the main house to look after it. And when they brought it up to the house, we had a visiting monk there. Some of you may know Bhante Gunaratna, Bhanteji from West Virginia. He was staying in Bodhinyana. And I always remember when he saw that little lamb, immediately he just went up to it and just touched it. I can still remember it in my mind's eye now. And just touched it so very gently on the head. And he had so much gentleness and so much metta in that simple gesture. And so whenever I remember that, then that feeling of metta just comes back to me. So this is just one memory. And I'm sure that all of you have memories and times in your life when you've experienced something similar. So this is one way which can be very powerful for bringing back that feeling. Of course, remember that in meditation, of course, you know, meditation is supposed to be about the present moment and so on and so forth, so we're not supposed to get lost in our memories. But this is not a case where you're getting lost in memories. This is a case where you're consciously using your memory in a positive way in order to help your meditation. Okay? So you don't have to worry about that. And then you use that. When the feeling comes up, And then when the feeling comes up, then you focus on the feeling. Leave the memory behind, you focus on the feeling, and then bring that feeling back in. May I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. And then you keep that feeling going. Another way that you can use sometimes is, and I know some people who do this, is to keep a picture nearby. So you can maybe keep a picture of some cute little kittens or something like that. And that can help you to do metta. Usually, actually, when I do a metta retreat, I usually have a teddy bear with me. So I forgot to bring a teddy bear with me to this retreat. Actually, if anybody has a teddy bear, it was quite funny. Last time I did a retreat at Jhana Grove in Perth, and again, I forgot to bring a teddy bear. And I said, did anybody bring a teddy bear on retreat? And somebody's like, yeah, I brought my teddy bear. So then we get the teddy bear, and we put the teddy bear up at the front, and Teddy sits meditation for the whole retreat. And you know, it's so amazing. Teddy just sits there, so still. It's really astonishing. You wouldn't believe what a good meditator Teddy is, because he just doesn't have any issues. Teddy just sits there so serene. So if you're sitting there in meditation and everything just seems a bit too much sometimes, then you can just open your eyes and you look, and there's Teddy sitting very peacefully. You think, ah, if only I can meditate like Teddy one day. So that's a good way to bring that into practice, because often when we're on retreat, things become very intense and they become very serious. Yeah. And one time when I was in Malaysia and I was with Ajahn Brahm, we would travel to different places, and we went to one meditation center, and it had the board on the meditation center, and it said, rules for meditators. Rule number one, meditate seriously. I said to Ajahn Brahm, I said, that's finished. No one's going to do any proper meditation here. Meditate seriously, furrowed brow. I wanted to scrub it out and put meditate playfully on there. Yeah. So having that kind of playful attitude can be good. In fact, another thing that you can do, if you can't get the feeling of metta going, is just to give up. Just give up. You say, okay, I can't meditate. Who am I to think I can meditate? I'll just forget it. I'm not even going to try meditating. Yeah? So I'm just going to completely give up, and I'll never be a meditator anymore. But what I might do is I might just pretend to meditate. So I can't actually meditate, but at least I can sit here and look like a meditator. And I can't actually be mindful, but at least I can pretend, I can do play mindfulness, as if I was being mindful. And I can't actually feel metta because my heart is a desert and I have no emotions. Yeah? But I can pretend to feel metta, yeah? As if you're like in a play or something like that. What would it be like if I was to really feel metta? And then you just pretend to meditate. But you're not actually meditating, because if you're actually meditating, that would be too serious, and you can't do that, okay? But then you just do pretend meditation, yeah? And so if you just do that sometimes, that also can be helpful, yeah? Because you stop taking it so seriously, yeah? And that's so much of what stands in the way of meditation being successful, especially metta meditation. We take it so seriously. So we just stop taking it seriously, play around with it. So these are a few tips, a few hints, a few ideas that can be useful for getting that feeling of metta alive, for catching that spark. Ultimately, though, that is one thing that I can't do as a teacher, yeah? It would be very nice if I could kind of walk around the room and just sort of being light the spark of metta in all of your hearts. I would love to be able to do that. Unfortunately, I can't. So all I can do is teach the method and give you some encouragement. And we look in there, and we have to find in ourselves the ability to do that. Yeah. And that's ultimately something which is very subjective. And that's something actually that I like very much about the meditation approach in the Thai forest tradition. I remember once being with one of the Thai forest monks, Ajahn Dunn, and somebody was asking him some questions about meditation. In this case, it was meditation on death. And he was telling them how to meditate on a corpse which had died. And he was saying that you have to, it's not just the matter of visualizing the corpse, but it's a matter of giving rise to that feeling of dispassion and letting go, of not grasping onto life. And that's what gives rise to the peace. And then the person who was asking the question said, well, how do you do that? How do you make that feeling arise? And Ajahn Dunn said, well, I can't teach you that. He said, you have to find that for yourself. Yeah. And so in the Thai tradition, there's a very much emphasis on this subjective side of meditation. Yeah. What is it actually that you're bringing to that meditation? And that's what really determines what the outcome of the practice is. It's not so much actually what the method is. I gave that little story earlier about, you know, meditation method being to distract us from our practice. I mean, I was only half joking. You probably guessed I was half joking and half serious. But they found similar things, for example, in psychology, and this has actually been studied in psychology, and they found out that if you do different kinds of therapeutic methods, okay, so you maybe do, you know, analytical psychology or Jungian psychology, or have all these different kinds of psychology, the different methods accounts for about 10% of the outcome of the process of therapy. Yeah? Most of the outcome is determined by the patient, a significant percentage is by the therapist, and only about 10% is due to the theory that the therapist is using to guide the practice. And I think probably the similar thing is true in meditation. I don't know if anybody's actually studied it, but it would be interesting to do that. I mean, it'd be quite possible to study it. You get different groups of meditators doing different methods and see what the different outcome is. And I suspect we'd find a similar thing, that only a small percentage of the different outcome was due to the actual method. So this method that I've been teaching with you and sharing with you, this is one way to go about it. Don't mistake the method for the thing itself. Right? The method is just a collection of hints and tips which is there to help you in your meditation, that's all. Okay, so don't mistake that for the actual meditation itself. What is it that I can bring to that? What is that quality of mind, that quality of attention? What is the manner in which I evoke that meditation, in which I place my mind towards that meditation? That's that quality of attention which is going to really determine how the meditation works. So that's probably enough talking for now. Why don't we do some more guided meditation, and then we can have some Q&A. Okay, so in this meditation we're going to do metta for oneself and for the loved person. So before we start, I want everybody to think of one loved person that you can use in the meditation. So just think of them first and then put them to one side, and we'll come back to them during the meditation itself. So sitting quietly. Allowing the mind to settle back inside the body. Not worrying about the past, not running off to the future, being still, present, here, now. Leaving the mind focused in the heart. Say to oneself the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Repeating those words again and again and again. Evenly, steadily, clearly, making a firm foundation for the mind. May I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. evoking that pure, wholesome wish for your own true happiness and well-being. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Noticing deep within the heart, along with those words of metta, is also the feeling of metta. Soft, gentle feeling of loving kindness. Like the gentle glow around a candle flame. When you notice that feeling, gently hold that feeling as if you're holding a little baby bird. And if you're holding that bird, you'd want to keep it so safe so that it didn't fly out and fly away, but so delicately so that you didn't crush it or hurt it in any way. It's the same way we bring to the feeling of metta, holding it gently, but very securely. as the feeling becomes more clear and steady, we move the mind through the different parts of the body, just gently sweeping through the body and taking the feeling of metta with it, so that every part of the body is soaked through with the feeling of metta. Just like a cloth or a sponge would be soaked through with water until every fiber was filled with water. In the same way, the whole body from the top of the head to the soles of the feet, from the hairs on your skin to the marrow of the bones, is soaked and suffused with the gentle feeling of loving kindness. when the feeling of metta is settled and still through the whole body, then it's time to move to the second stage, metta for the loved one. So we keep our mind still, keep awareness focused exactly as it is inside the body, and we simply introduce the name of that loved person into the words of metta. So for example, if I choose my father, then may my father be happy. May my father be happy. May my father be happy. Or whoever you've chosen for that loved one, may they be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. Not sending the mind over there to where that person is. Keeping it here, focused inside the body. nectar back to oneself. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Letting the words of metta go. Letting the feeling of metta fade away. Allowing the mind to return to a neutral state, empty, open, clear. And with the mind empty and clear, just take a minute to reflect and review over the meditation we've just done together. Inquiring into cause and effect. What just happened? How did I use my mind? How did my mind change during that meditation? What did the metta feel like at different stages of the meditation? And what is my mind like now? Compared to how it was at the start of the meditation. Finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu. Then you can mindfully open your eyes and come out of meditation. Okay, so now it's over to you. Any questions? It's a terrible time to have questions, isn't it? I meditated, everyone's mind's peaceful, it's a bit late at night, everyone's a bit tired. But anyway, here we are. This mic is working. Okay. Any questions? We have one down the back there, yeah. There you go.
Hi, Ajahn. Hi. I got some feeling, but I'm not sure is it the metta feeling. Sometimes in the afternoon it's a bit numb, you can feel it in the chest. And then just now it's a bit, just a very light feeling, but I'm not sure if there's metta.
That's fine, yeah. Don't worry about whether it's the real thing or not. You can just pretend it's the real one. As long as it feels peaceful and feels happy, then it's okay. Yeah, you don't have to worry, is this the real one or not? Yeah. Actually, you know, the feeling, the way that the feeling appears will change. It will differ from time to time. That's just the nature of the mind. It changes according to conditions. But the basic intention of it and the basic quality of it will be the same. And over time, as you practice, You kind of learn to recognize it has that particular flavor, that particular quality, which you learn to recognize as the flavor of metta. Yeah, but don't worry about whether it's the right one or not. If it feels okay, then that's good. Okay, next question.
difficult to wish myself well and happy because I was telling, I kept telling myself I'm already reasonably happy. But when I was wishing that for my mom, I felt joy in my heart. I've lost my mom anyway, but I know I was genuinely wanting her to be happy. So how do I help myself? Because I don't find it easy to do that for myself.
Just take that same feeling and then bring it back to yourself. Yeah, keep on doing it until it works. That's all. There's no great secret to it, but just have to kind of accept, like it or not, you are a sentient being, deserving of happiness, just as much as anybody else. Yeah? So that's all.
At one time when I was really suffering, yes, I could actually do that for myself. It's like practically every day I would just wish myself that and I feel better. But now it's like I'm not really in that state. So when I wish myself, I feel that it wasn't really genuine because probably that was not really what I needed. I don't know. So maybe in future, could I just shorten that part, wishing myself first? And then wish for my mom and then transfer it.
If you want, you can play around with it like that and see how it works. But ultimately, you know, if you listen to what you're saying there, your mind is still discriminating. You're still differentiating me when I'm happy, me when I'm not happy, me is different from my mom is different and all of those things. Wipe them all away. Clean the board off. We don't want those discriminations. Who cares whether you're happy or sad? Who cares whether it's you or your mom or whatever? May you be happy. That's all that matters. Yeah? So just don't worry about all of those other things. Yeah? So that's the purpose of the meditation. Yeah? It's just to have that like wave of metta, and it just wipes over all of those things. So those differences honestly just don't matter.
Jen, I would like to ask why we cannot transfer the why we cannot radiate the metta to the departed ones? Because and then what is the difference by radiating metta to the departed ones and transfer the merits? Thank you.
Yeah. You can spread metta to departed ones. That's not a problem. Okay. All I was talking about was doing metta actually in the meditation itself, okay? Because in the meditation, it becomes very, very refined, okay? Even very, very slight little things, which normally don't matter, but they can actually disturb your meditation. So if you have, for example, like a feeling of grief, maybe normally, you know, you might maybe someone who's departed, your family or parents or something like that, and normally you can spread metta to them and so on, and you've got quite well adjusted to the fact that they've passed on, and you can do the metta and it doesn't really matter. But when you're doing the metta meditation, okay, only talking about the actual formal meditation sitting, not any other time, only in that time, your mind is becoming much more sensitive. Yeah, it's 10 times as sensitive, 100 times as sensitive, 1,000 times as sensitive. And so any kind of residual emotion or feeling of grief or loss or regret or anything like that can suddenly reappear even after many, many years, and you think that you're completely over it, but suddenly it can just come back, yeah? And then that can just overwhelm your meditation and turn it from being a beautiful, happy meditation into being a beautiful, crying, sobbing, sad meditation, yeah? Yeah? So that's why it's only because actually in the meditation itself, we have to be very, very refined, very selective about how we're going about it, because even those kind of subtle feelings and emotions become amplified in that setting. Yeah.
Hi, Ajahn. If supposing if we cannot feel for either of the stages, whether it's the first stage or the second stage, so is there one particular stage that we should just stick with?
Sorry, I didn't quite get the question. Is there? Well, I didn't quite understand that last sentence.
Should we actually just stay with either one of the stages if let's say we cannot evoke the feeling?
Yeah, just
That's the first question.
Yeah, so just for the time being, just keep trying, okay? If you find that after trying for some time, and you know I've given out some tips and tricks this evening, and you can maybe try to think of a few more that might work, okay? And if after trying a few different tricks and different ways of doing things and being patient and so on and so forth, if you find that it's still not getting any response from it, then probably says that maybe you should try a different meditation. Yeah? So that's all. It's no big deal. The Buddha taught 40 different kinds of meditation. So when you've tried the 40 ones, okay, and none of them work, okay, then that's pretty depressing. But if we've only tried one or two, actually, there's even more than 40. And you know, the Buddha was a master of skillful means, yeah? So he always had something to help people, even if they couldn't do formal meditation. And there's many stories like that as well. So for the time being, just be patient. Stick with, if the feeling is not coming, then stick with either the first person or the second person. So either yourself or a loved one, yeah? And see how you go.
Okay. And the other question is, if in a process of waiting for that feeling to come, and if we experience drowsiness, so should we just be aware of that drowsiness and see where that goes, or what do we do?
If it's just a little bit of drowsiness, then just keep going, okay? But if your mind becomes very kind of strongly drowsy, so that, you know, you're almost like falling asleep, then best to just stop the meditation. And then you can either just sit and wait, because sometimes your body actually just has cycles, doesn't it, yeah? And you'll be sitting there in meditation, and you'll go for a period of time, and the body will be drowsy, your mind will be drowsy, and then you sit for a while, and then it suddenly comes good, yeah? That happens, you know, usually a few times during the day, and it's just the energy cycles in the body. So there's no particular point in trying to fight it. It's not going to get you anywhere. So just wait for the drowsiness to go. Sometimes maybe just get up and go for a walk. Wait till that passes, and then come back and try again.
Okay. And the third question is, I find the trick of pretending interesting, but if let's say we in the first place have not experienced that feeling before, so how do we pretend that we have that feeling? Because perhaps the question is that you don't even know what's that feeling.
Well, maybe you could just do like a little play acting, as if you're sort of putting on a play. And, you know, you can, if you're putting on a play, you can imagine that if somebody was doing a play, and if they were pretending to be someone who's very angry, yeah? So they kind of got an angry face and angry actions and angry words, that they'd actually feel angry, yeah? And so the same way that you can maybe put on a play in your mind and have a play of being somebody who's very loving, yeah? And so you maybe think of somebody who's very loving, like the Buddha, or could be anybody. And just imagine yourself pretending to be that person, yeah? And what would they act like? What would they look like? How would they behave? What would they say?
Okay, thank you.
Ajahn, my question is, when we reach, let's say if one find peace, reach the peacefulness in meditation, or reach the metta, then what should one do? Like, how long do you stay in that peacefulness or metta? Or what do you do with that feeling?
Okay, you just stay there for as long as you can. Yeah, if the feeling is flowing, just stay there. Now, when the first feeling arises, as I described a bit earlier, usually it arises in a particular part of the body, okay? It could be anywhere, but it will usually arise in one place. So you keep that there and then spread it out until it's full through your whole body, yeah? Once it's full and you can feel it through your whole body, then just keep it there, yeah? Keep it there, keep it there, keep it there. 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, even longer. Doesn't matter. The longer, the better, yeah? And then if you want to go to the higher stages, if the metta is still flowing in that way, then you can go to the loved person and then to the neutral person, the disliked person. I'll talk more about those stages tomorrow. Okay? But basically, as long as the metta is flowing, then keep doing it. When you feel that the energy starts to drop back, yeah, like you've been doing it for a while, and then the energy is starting to fall back, don't push it, okay? You learn to recognize, oh, okay, now the meditation's coming to an end. So you just say, okay, then you come back, let the mind come back to neutral, okay? So don't force it.
Another question. One of the precepts that we need to do is to not sleep on the high-rise bed. Can you explain a little bit more whether that will help with meditations?
The basic point is not to kind of have too much kind of luxurious bedding that will make you sleep all the time. Yeah, that's the basic point. So as long as you're getting a decent good night's sleep, but not kind of indulging in just lying around in bed all day, then that's okay. Yeah.
Because for our case, we are here. There is no bed anyway. So if at night time we sleep on our bed, would that matter?
Look, I wouldn't worry about it. Yeah, just sleep wherever is appropriate, and get up and do some meditation in the morning. What's more of a worry really is to make sure that people get a good night's sleep. Because there's nothing worse than being on a meditation retreat and just being really sleepy because you haven't got a good night's sleep. Yeah.
Ajahn, you mentioned that in these metta meditations we have to recognize the sensation in our different body parts, right? What kind of sensation we are looking? Is it like warm feeling, or is it together hand in hand with the happiness feeling?
It is the happiness feeling. That's what I'm talking about.
Mm.
Yeah.
So it's a happiness feeling in different parts of body.
That's right. Yeah. So you feel it like a feeling of pleasure. Often it will feel a little bit warm. But really the feeling is in your mind. Of course, yeah, it's not actually in your body, but you experience it as if it's in your body. And the way that the feeling appears is just a matter of perception, okay? So that's why it can appear in different ways. It can feel sometimes warm, sometimes maybe even a bit cool. It can feel bright, or it can feel like it's got a buzzing texture to it. It can feel in different ways. Those things don't matter. But the main thing is that it has that feeling of pleasure to it. And so that you can keep, because it's the pleasure which attracts your mind to it and will keep your mind on the feeling. Yeah.
So generally you feel happy when you are doing metta, right? But sometimes if the happiness is not that strong, we could just increase by trying to recall the memories and whatever we can do to
If you don't... As a general rule of thumb, I would say to those techniques of using memories and imagination and things that I mentioned earlier, only usually use them if you don't have any feeling of metta at all, okay, to try to get the feeling coming. Once the feeling of metta is there, then you want to try to develop that just by using the art of attention and the way that you're holding and being mindful and being aware of the feeling, yeah? And that's the real meditation. All of that other stuff, really, is just frippery. That's just beginner's tricks, okay? It's really got nothing to do with the meditation. That's just to give yourself a bit of a kickstart if you're having trouble at the beginning. The real meditation is when you have that feeling of metta and the art of paying attention to that. It's a very delicate art. And if the feeling's there and if you pay attention in the right way, there's like a feedback effect, so that the feeling will gradually grow stronger and the awareness will become brighter and the feeling will be stronger and the awareness will get closer and it will gradually will build up. Yeah, but that's a very, very delicate art. Yeah, if you push too hard, then you'll squeeze it out of existence. If you're too far away, it will get vague and gradually fade away. Yeah? But it's just that right paying attention. So if you're paying attention to it, and if the feeling starts to get a bit dull, then you can compensate by applying your mind a little bit more firmly, just a tiny, tiny bit more firmly applying on the feeling. Or if you feel that the feeling is getting a bit tight, a bit constricted, then you ease off just a tiny, tiny bit. But this is where you're learning that delicate art of attention. Yeah, and that's really what will cause the feeling of the metta to develop and to deepen in the long run.
Thank you, Ajahn.
I find it is easier to imagine your own organs, you know, running through your own organs. Do you think it went to my stomach? I felt it went to my stomach.
Okay, that's all right.
So I feel good.
Yeah, stomach's all right. Organs is fine. As long as you're inside the body, it's fine. Yeah. I mean, you know, often people find it easier to imagine the skeleton because the skeleton's, I guess we all have a clear idea or a clear image of what a skeleton looks like. But yeah, it doesn't matter at all. That's just as long as it's inside your body is the important thing. And that's something which will really pay off later on. As the meditation gets deeper, you will really find that that's where the solidity of the meditation comes from. That's the difference between samadhi, yeah, the metta that you develop in samadhi, and just ordinary loving kindness. That metta you develop in samadhi has a solidity to it, and that solidity comes from the focus and the consistency of how we're developing it inside the body. But you'll only know what that feels like later on. You won't really notice it in the beginning, but later on you'll realize why it is that we've developed it that way. Okay, so there's another question over here. Yeah.
When you say, may I be happy, who are you speaking to, or to what are you...
speaking to yourself.
Who are you addressing?
Addressing yourself.
Your subconscious?
No, just yourself.
So it's just a suggestion to yourself?
Yeah, it's an auto-suggestion. Yeah, almost like auto-hypnosis. Actually, I have a student in Sydney who's a hypnotist, and she said, you're just doing hypnosis on people. I said, no, I'm not. She said, yes, you are. But the difference from hypnosis, because in hypnosis you go into like a trance where you become suggestible. Yeah, and you sort of lose control of what you're doing. So in meditation, you never kind of you have that element of mindfulness is always prominent. So you're not suggestible in the same way as you are under hypnosis. Okay, so if I was to say, you know, you sit there and meditate and wish, may I be happy. Okay, now jump up and dance around on one leg. Then you're not going to do that. At least I hope. I don't know. Maybe you would. Maybe I should try that in the next meditation. It'd be quite fun. But because we're not trying to deprive people of that control, so it's a bit different. But it's still the same way. It's an auto-suggestion. It's just making that suggestion. And by making that suggestion, just continually and repeatedly, that's what gives rise to the feeling.
Hi, Ajahn. There were a couple of times this evening when I was meditating that the moment I closed my eyes, there's this shaking, you know, in the darkness there was this shaking. So I'm not sure if it's because I'm hungry or is it part of the development of meditation. It was really shaking, like earthquake, mild earthquake. When I close my eyes.
Are you really that hungry?
Actually not, just a little bit hungry.
No, I don't think that's hunger. I think that's a symptom of what I talked a little bit about yesterday, of what we call rapture. And what really is happening is that when you meditate, our attention and our energies are always moving outside. Yeah, so we see things and our mind goes out to what we see. We hear things, our mind goes out to what we hear. We think about things, our mind goes out to what we think about. So our energies and our actions are always moving outside. And so when we come to meditation, we bring all those energies back in. Yeah, it's like we're shepherding the energies back inside. And so our body and our frame and our mind are suddenly dealing with an intensity of energy which is not used to dealing with. Yeah. It's like it's got some of this influx of energy. And so that manifests, especially when we're beginning, it manifests in various different kinds of ways because it hasn't learnt to really balance itself properly. What you're describing is one such way, yeah? And then you can feel like that's a kind of a shaking and so on. Sometimes you might be swaying in meditation. All kinds of different things can happen. You know, maybe you might find, for example, some people will find that they can't sleep. You know, they come here all the way through the meditation, and then some people go home tonight, and I bet, you know, in this room there'll probably be at least a couple of people who won't be able to sleep tonight. It's because of energy built up, yeah, which you don't realize. Actually, you can be sitting in meditation, and you might feel very tired and very sleepy. You feel like you don't have any energy. And it's only afterwards you realize, my goodness, you know, how much energy has been built up by containing it like that. So these kinds of different symptoms that happen from time to time, don't worry about them too much. Almost all the time, they just pass naturally. Okay, so you don't really have to do anything. Just be mindful. Oh, okay, that's how that is. And then usually after a day or two, you'll find that they just pass by themselves. If you find that they don't pass by themselves, if they persist over a longer period of time, then maybe you need to look at doing something about it, to something to counteract it or bring it back into balance. But if it just happens for a short period, just don't worry about it.
Thank you.
Just a question. If supposing we can't evoke that feeling, would it help if we, I don't know, watch a comedy?
Can.
And.
You can watch a cute YouTube video of a kitten or something like that.
Okay. And would that be the feeling that we are trying to evoke if it is a comedy that brings...
I don't know. It depends what kind of comedy.
Okay.
But look, it can be, you know. And, of course, the thing is that with those kinds of things, of course, they will evoke emotions. And that's why people like watching films and comedies and TV shows and things like that, because they do evoke emotions. And because, you know, people want to feel... So even if it's like a horror movie, people want to feel, because at least they're alive. You know that if you're terrified, you must be alive. Yeah. So this is what all of these things, they're designed to actually provoke some kind of feeling. And of course there are, you know, some of them which do evoke that feeling of metta. Yeah. And it is a genuine feeling. It can be a genuine response. The problem, of course, is that it's not evoked in a way that's very peaceful or very sustainable. Yeah. It's usually it just kind of comes up and then it goes away. So it doesn't really get you very far. You know, maybe you feel pleasant for a few minutes or something like that, but then it finishes, and you can't just keep on doing that, yeah? Even if it's the same thing, you can't just keep watching it because the feeling won't be there after a while, yeah? So those things can, you know, they can, you know, lift your mood or something like that to some degree, but they still stay at a fairly shallow level.
Okay, so it's probably quite shallow. So, for example, just watch Mr. Bean... And uh-huh. Laugh at his antics and then try and say that, okay, let's try and evoke that same feeling. It's not that weird.
No, it's not weird. No, you can do that. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, another question. I'm so sorry, I must confess that in terms of the issue on hunger, I think I'm not used to it. So yesterday I felt hungry. At night.
Oh dear, that's terrible.
So So I'm sorry that I actually had something light. So I'm not sure if I broke something.
You've confessed in front of everyone now. We all know what a dreadful person you are. As I said yesterday, the precepts is sikkhapadang samadiyami. I am to take the way of training. Yeah. So it's always something that you try to do. With the precept of not eating in the evening, it is very individual. Many people will not do that, and it's fine. They don't notice it at all to go without dinner. And for some people, it depends on your constitution. Then it can actually be quite difficult, and especially if you're not used to it. So that's fine. Just see how you go in the future. And of course, there are some different things which are allowable in the afternoon, like some fruit juice or something like that. But if you need to have something light in the evening, then that's fine. Don't worry about it.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions? Okay, I think, this is about time now, 9 o'clock.